Hello and welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm your host, Bill Howell, and as always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. We've got some great interviews this month, but as always, let's get started with beer news. Tickets are now on sale for the Alaska Craft Brew and Barley Wine Festival. It will be at the Denina Center in Anchorage on Friday, February 31st and Saturday, February 1st. As usual, there will be three sessions, Friday evening from 6 to 10 p.m., Saturday afternoon from noon to 4 p.m., and Saturday evening from 6 to 10 p.m. Tickets are available from My Alaska Tix. General admission tickets are $75 and designated driver tickets are $10. Each session will feature a different live band. The winners of the commercial competition in the barley wine and winter warmer categories will be announced during the Saturday afternoon session. This year's Frozen River Fest will be held at Soldotna Creek Park from 4 to 8 p.m. on Saturday, February 15th. This is a uniquely Alaskan experience featuring brews from across the state, live music, crackling bonfires, food trucks, and a fireworks show illuminating the Kenai River's frozen riverbanks. Tickets will be on sale soon. We'll have more on this later in the show when I interview Joe Spady of the Soldotna Chamber of Commerce. On Tuesdays from 4 to 7 p.m., Homer Brewing Company will be hosting a cribbage night through the end of March. Bring your boards and enjoy some pints while you peg. That's it for this month's beer news. Up next, we'll have our first interview with Ted Rosenzweig of Turn Again Brewing.
It's pick-click give time for Alaskans. When you file for the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, you can support your favorite nonprofit organizations. Do you value public radio? Donations help KDLL provide the news, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Apply for your dividend at pfd.alaska.gov by March 31st and pick click give to help your favorite organizations. Thanks.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Up next, we've got Ted Rosenzweig, the owner slash founder of Turn Again Brewing in Anchorage. Ted, how are you doing today, sir?
Really good. Kind of busy as usual.
Well, thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to talk with us. So let's talk a little bit about Turn Again. Why don't you describe your operation to those of our listeners who might not be familiar with it?
We are a 10-barrel brewery in Anchorage, and our facility is kind of unique amongst breweries because it's really two breweries in one. We've got a hard line of separation between that half of the brewery that does non-sour beers and that half that does exclusively sour beers. So we've duplicated our equipment to allow us to really dive deeply and thoroughly into souring without the risk of contaminating and making our normal beers sour. We were founded and started up in 2018, so we're in our sixth year of operation, and we make a huge array of beers, Belgians, sours, fruited beers, lagers, a whole array of ales, And we do all of them fairly well. We've highly decorated in statewide competition for basically every style that we, every kind of beer we make.
Yeah, I know you guys have done some fantastic, as you say, sour beers. Your stuff is primarily bottled in bombers, is that correct? 22 ounces?
All of our products are exclusively in the bottle, yeah. And I could tell you why if you want
to. Sure, go ahead.
There is a liner inside of every can that contains BPA, and for normal beer products that aren't sour, it's not thought to be problematic, but there's a theoretical risk that a sour beer, and especially a pasteurized sour beer, is at risk to get that BPA substance, which is a estrogen mimetic compound, into the beverage. And so we chose at our outset not to ever risk our drinking public getting exposed to that. So we bottle exclusively, and that's much safer.
Do you guys, I honestly don't know, do you guys keg as well?
We do keg, yeah.
You do keg. So it's available on draft in some locations up in Anchorage?
Quite a few, yeah.
Okay. So how did you end up in this crazy business of brewing beer? What's your background?
So I'm a physician, and when I was in training as a medical student, my wife, who is a biologist, was working in a lab in Colorado when craft beer was just getting its start in the late 80s. And her lab mates were yeast biologists who taught her how to home brew. And eventually a bunch of them wound up in the brewing industry in Colorado. But we kind of caught the home brewing bug at that time. And I really fell in love with it and found myself home brewing, you know, in the 90s and 2000s as we moved around the country. And so I asked myself, you know, what am I going to do when I step away from medicine? And the obvious answer was brew. So we started brewing more intensively at home. I obtained beer judge certification. I went to University of UC Davis Brewing School for some brewing training, and simultaneously operated a brewery and medicine at the same time. And then a couple years ago, stepped almost completely away from medicine and just went full time at the brewery.
So I'm kind of familiar with your place, but again, for our listeners who aren't, what's your tap room like?
We have two floors that are serviced by a single draft line on the ground floor. We have about 20 available offerings at any given moment. So yeah, about 20 tap lines, huge array of our full range of products. The upstairs has nice views of the Chugach. It's very warm, comfortable place. And I don't know what else to tell you. We can easily take about 60 warm bodies in here at a given time. About 35 upstairs, maybe 25 downstairs.
And you guys are strictly a tap room, right? No food?
We have food trucks, and then my wife has a cottage permit to do snacks. So she does nuts and cookies. Mm. And those are always available. And then food trucks frequently are on site.
So let's talk a little bit about your brewing philosophy. You said you guys obviously putting a lot of effort into sours. Why do you find sours so interesting?
Because they're challenging. And a lot of other breweries are kind of terrified of the prospects of having souring organisms get loose in their brewery. But we have the facility, the equipment, and the microbiologic expertise to do that without risk. And so far, so good. We haven't had any contamination issues, but making sour beers is really challenging to get right. And so when I was a home brewer, I felt that was, you know, my highest calling was to make high quality, you know, mature sour beers. And when I got the hang of it, it was time to go pro. Most breweries will do a quick souring in the kettle. It's called kettle souring, which doesn't really pose much risk, but we don't do that here. All of our sour beers are matured and aged with lactobacillus and other souring organisms as long as they need to be. So it's usually about a 6-week process to make a sour beer here, and not a 2-day process like other local breweries.
So you're using the traditional mixed culture method. Are you doing anything with barrels and barrel aging as part of that?
Yeah, we have a robust barrel aging program. Most of our flagship sours are not barrel aged, but they are, you know, aged for usually 6 to 12 weeks with live organisms. And one cool thing that we do is we've sourced our house culture from wild. So we figured out long ago that what lives on Anchorage Alderwood makes for a very nice souring culture. So when we built the brewery, we added a huge 80 barrel tank, and that tank has arms which allow the beer to continuously be exposed to Alderwood from my backyard. So we filled that on day one, and it's remained more than 90% full for the last 6 years. We'll pull a little bit out to inoculate our large batch sour beers, and then we'll feed some fresh wort in to keep a stable biological process in that big tank, which we call the Solera.
I was going to say that sounds like the Solera method for sherry.
Yep.
So what do you see in your near future and then your longer term future? You got any new releases coming out? Anything special planned for Beer Week?
So we have a new release every week. We're small enough that we can be nimble and do ultra small batches and test batches. And let's see, today we debut a peanut porter. Next week we have a really fun flagship beer that was finished with hop extracts. There's some new hop extracts in the market, so we did a very small test batch and duplicated our Atlantic Haze Hazy IPA with these new products to see, you know, how they do. We'll have an Irish stout fired on nitro. We've got some really cool cutting edge technology for our nitro dispense system that'll be coming out for St. Pat's. I'm also a professor of brewing science at UAA, and my students and I were able to get some experimental hops and created a hazy IPA using those hops, and it was so good that in a few weeks we're going to release a big batch. It's called Lobo Marina for the public using this experimental hop. We've got some clean side barrel projects going. There's one that's in concert with Ginger in Anchorage, and they gave us a barrel that they had emptied of a rye whiskey. So we have an Imperial Stout maturing up in there, and that should release within the next month or two. We have our regular Imperial Stout that was released in December that's available as well. Boy, what else are we doing? We have a friend who passed away, and so as a commemorative Pilsner, we'll be out in about a month. So lots of projects, you know, every week it's something new.
You mentioned your involvement with the UAA Brewing Science Program. Why don't you give a few details about that? Perhaps some of our listeners might be interested in it.
So I got to collaborating with the chairman of the Department of Biology at UAA. She's also a biologist, obviously. And we first surveyed brewery owners throughout the state, and we were able to judge that there is a tremendous need for brewing personnel statewide. There's a market for new hires. And all of us brewery owners prefer to hire locals, and we prefer to hire people who have training. So that inspired the formation of basically a new department, Department of Brewing Science at UAA, and get accredited for a certificate program. It's basically a two-year degree program where you get a certificate. And the first order of business was to set up a curriculum. And my responsibilities were kind of threefold. First, to teach an introductory brewing science course, which is a semester long, I believe it was a three credit course, where basically just introduce students to brewing science as well as other fermented beverages and foods. And technically the degree is fermentation science. So we also talk about kimchi and pickles and wine and mead, as well as all the laws that apply both federally and locally to the industry. So I finished my first course in the fall semester. Going forward, there'll be a spring course, which is the 300 level kind of advanced brewing science, where we get really deep in the weeds of brewing science. And then the third course will be an internship, paid internship for students that are interested. So there's a host of breweries throughout the state that have agreed to host interns and pay them for usually summer internships. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we get some interest and get some folks through the program with adequate training who can be, you know, constructive members of the industry in the state.
Sounds like a good program. Kind of funny, when I was still working for the university, I tried to set up something similar about 15, 12 years ago, and no interest. So the times have changed. That's good to hear.
Yeah, I think the critical component was proving to the Board of Regents that there was a need, that there was demand for education, brewing education.
Where do you see Turnagain Brewing in 10 years? What's your long-term plan?
We are doing exactly what we love to do, and we have no real plans to grow outside of our walls or to do anything different than we're doing. We're in this business because we love the craft. And right now we're in a really good place. So I don't see a huge amount of growth. I don't see relocating the brewery. I don't see, you know, expanding and shipping beers outside the state. We are doing what we love to do right now. So more of the same, which is something different every week.
Anything else that you want to let our folks know about?
I will be at Frozen River. It was a great festival. I really enjoyed it. I hope the locals down there on the peninsula realize how cool that festival is compared to others in the state. And right now we're exclusively providing retail on the peninsula to Country Liquor.
Yeah, I know. I've seen your stuff there. Yep.
Yeah, Ben Jakinski down there is a great customer and a great person. So we really love having our stuff available.
Are you planning on entering anything into the best at the end of the month here for barley wine or winter warmer?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. We okay. have a winter warmer and two barley wines, which is the maximum allowed number of entries. So we will be, yeah, we'll be participating.
Great. I look forward to trying them.
Yeah, we'll be pouring down there as well. So if you're coming to Anchorage for the Craft Beer and Barley Wine Festival, we'll see you down there.
Well, we'll see you at Frozen River Festival. Thanks again for taking the time to talk with us, Ed. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I love talking about what I do because I love what I do. So thank you.
This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment.
Hey, hey there, pickle people. This is Murphy with the Veritas Variety Review. Check out Veritas every Saturday from 7 to 9 p.m. We got a rotating cast of players to mix it up for you. Find it here on the only listener-supported public radio station for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. For over half a century, one of the perennial arguments among anthropologists has been why mankind decided to shift from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to one based on agriculture. Prior to the middle of the 20th century, the subject was not really open to debate. Given the obvious, in hindsight, benefits that accrued from agriculture and the bread it produced, cities, writing, trade, etc., the assumption was that of course people settled down and began growing cereal grains in order to make bread. However, in 1953, the archaeologist Robert Braidwood posed this question to his colleagues during a now famous symposium. Quote, could the discovery that a mash of fermented grain yielded a palatable and nutritious beverage have acted as a greater stimulant towards the experimental selection and breeding of the cereals than the discovery of flour and bread making? One would assume that the utilization of wild cereals, along with edible roots and berries, as a source of collected food would have been in existence for millennia before the domestication, in a meaningful sense, took place. Was the subsequent impetus to this domestication beer or bread? While raged might be too strong a word, the academic discussion of this intriguing question went back and forth for about 60 years, with neither side being able to make any sort of compelling argument for its position. Food is a more basic need, and in the absence of evidence, many folks believe bread seemed the more likely spark for a change as revolutionary as domesticating crops. Others argued that the hunter-gatherer lifestyle provided plenty of nutrition. What it lacked was alcohol, whose mind and mood-altering effects would certainly have been in great demand amongst our Neolithic ancestors. As a beer lover, you can probably guess which side of the argument I personally came down on. But it seemed as though the argument would defy any true resolution due to the absence of any hard evidence one way or the other. However, all that changed in 2012. Göbekli Tepe is an archaeological site in Turkey that has challenged foundational ideas about the transition humans took from Neolithic hunter-gatherers to settled agriculturalists. The site consists of a number of buildings. Previously, when archaeologists unearthed sites of human construction, they assumed that the structures dated from a period of civilization. Buildings equaled settled communities. But Göbekli Tepe stood this theory on its head. Its buildings are of a particular type. Marked by T-shaped pillars up to 20 feet high, weighing 16 tons, archaeologists believe them to be worship sites, not dwellings. More intriguingly, there are no permanent settlements nearby. These structures were erected 12,000 years ago, but not as part of an early human civilization, but rather as a precursor to it. One of the best ways to comprehend just how ancient Göbekli Tepe is would be to compare it to other things that are considered incredibly ancient. Göbekli Tepe predates Stonehenge, one of the most famous prehistoric construction feats in human history, by over 6,000 years. The site predates the era of Sumer, considered one of the earliest true civilizations, and the invention of writing by a similar 600-year-ish margin. To put things in perspective, there was about as much time between the construction of Göbekli Tepe and the construction of Stonehenge as there is between the construction of Stonehenge and today. This site dates to what is known as the pre-pottery Neolithic era. Recent discoveries at this site include a remarkable painted boar statue adorned with white, red, and black pigments, which is considered one of the oldest painted statues from the Mesolithic period. This boar statue was found on a stone bench adorned with various symbols, including an H-shaped symbol crescent snakes, and human faces. At Karahan Tepe, another site from the same period, situated about 25 miles away from Göbekli Tepe, researchers uncovered a 2.3 meter tall statue, which is described as one of the most impressive examples of prehistoric art. The lifelike statue depicts a seated figure holding a phallus in both hands. This statue, dating back to around 9400 BCE, is considered the earliest example of a realistic human sculpture and is taller than the famous Urfa man, making it one of the most ancient depictions of a human. Even more fascinating from the beer lover's point of view was the discovery of six large limestone vessels. These barrel or trough-shaped vessels with capacities of up to 160 liters were noted to carry gray-black adhesions. Analyses made of these substances returned positive for calcium oxalate, also known as beer stone, a substance that develops in the course of the soaking, mashing, and fermenting of grain. So here we have evidence of brewing taking place at Göbekli Tepe well before settled agriculture. Even more intriguingly, results from genetic analyses undertaken by a team from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences in Oslo have suggested that the earliest domestication of grain occurred in the very near vicinity of Göbekli Tepe. Given that Göbekli Tepe seems to be primarily a ritual religious site, it's easy to postulate that hunter-gatherers from the surrounding area would gather there periodically to worship and labor on building and expanding the site. The entire complex was probably built over several generations, just like the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe. Production and consumption of alcohol beverages and ritual feasting would have been a key element in the social glue that could bring these disparate and nomadic groups together on a regular basis. Alcohol serves both ritual and social functions and has a magical, transcendent, mind-altering capacity. Unlike food, which appears naturally in the environment, alcohol must be manufactured. Humans didn't need to settle down to produce food. If the structures of Göbekli Tepe tell us anything, it's that 12,000 years ago, our ancestors had enough surplus time and energy that they could use it to build the equivalent of a Neolithic cathedral. The motivation to produce beer, a substance they could not reliably produce without agriculture, would be a pretty obvious one for Neolithic people looking to spend more time praying, celebrating, and feasting. So while the debate is by no means 100% settled, arguments appear to be tilting strongly towards the beer side of the question. If true, this means we have beer to thank for all the blessings and problems that we have received from what we so optimistically call civilization. As Homer Simpson says, here's to alcohol, the cause of and solution to all life's problems. We'll be right back with our next segment.
Hello, this is Trellisa Megan, known as Truth Is.
And I'm her trusty sidekick, Eva Knutson.
And we are the Sound Hunters.
Join us on Wednesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. as we dig through our old mixtape collections and share our favorite eclectic musical finds.
That's the Sound Hunters on Wednesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Up next, we've got an interview with Joe Spady, the event coordinator of the Soldotna Chamber of Commerce. Joe, how are you doing, sir?
I'm great. How are you, Bill?
I'm doing well. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us. So let's talk Frozen River Fest, huh?
Yes, we're so excited. Coming up soon.
Yep, it's the 15th, right? Saturday the 15th?
Sir. Yes, Frozen River Fest is the third Saturday of every February, so it falls on the 15th this year. So, and it runs from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's just a phenomenal time.
Yeah, it's always a great time, even if it is a little bit of a crapshoot with the weather. I've seen it where we were below zero and the wind howling, and other times when it was kind of like it is today, warm and nasty. So.
I know. Yeah, we're wondering how frozen everything's going to be for this event. We'll see.
Do we have a count for how many breweries we're expecting?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So I think I have just like 12, about a dozen right now signed up. And then I've got more people in the works that we are reaching out to. I'll be sending out a follow-up email probably later today just to check in with a few of those breweries that usually come but haven't signed up just yet. Yeah, we've got a great list of people. I'm excited to see all these brewers. Some of them are returning. Some of them are coming for the first time or maybe the first time in a few years. So it's going
to
be great.
That's always great when we get some newcomers. People really love the chance to try something different. So what I always tell people is whoever shows up, whoever the new guy is, they're probably going to win the People's Choice Award for being
true.
The new guy. And I gotta know, we're having some pretty good music at it too, right?
Yes, always. So yeah, we've got two local bands. Actually, just booked Bunny Swan. She always brings out a phenomenal group of local musicians together for her band. And then I have another band lining up right now. I haven't quite confirmed it yet, but looks like it's going to be amazing as well. So yeah, some wonderful music, lots of great food trucks. And of course, we wrap up the whole night with fireworks. It's just a great event.
So tickets, I don't think at the time of this tape, and they're not on sale yet. You got an idea when they're going to go on sale?
They actually just went on sale on yesterday.
Okay.
I sent out the newsletter with a link. I'll get everything updated before I head out today. But yeah, sale tickets just went on sale just now. So there's tickets available on our Ticket Leap website that for someone who's drinking, that'll come with 4 tokens and your tasting cup. But there's also those who won't be drinking and just want to join all the festivities as well. So all those tickets are available online.
And how much are they going to cost?
So $40. So $40 for the tasting with 4 8-ounce pours. And then the non-drinking is just $10. And then the event is free for all kids 12 and under. There's always a lot of kids playing, making snowmen and watching the fireworks. It's just a blast.
Great. Yeah, I appreciate this. This is one of those events where you can actually have your kids at it. And so make it a family event instead of just 21 and over. So that's super.
I do love that. It's such a great family event. And it especially for a beer festival, that's just not necessarily what people assume. But really, this event comes together so beautifully as a community event.
Yeah. And so you said the ticket included 4 sampling tokens, and then I assume
Correct.
That you can purchase additional ones there if you want, you're so inclined, right?
Yes, so we'll definitely have our ticket booth available there where we'll be sending extra tokens as well as some merch and things like that just to fill out the evening. Always lots of fun.
And fire pits again from BAFCO, I assume?
We definitely will have our fire pits available that our city park supplies. But we'll reach out. We've contacted BAFCO. They haven't been able to come the last couple of years just because it totally depends on how much they have in stock and to be able to bring down. So they will be getting an email tonight just to make sure that they know that they're invited and they're welcome if they're able to make it. But we are so lucky that Soldotna Parks and Rec has a great collection of fire pits that we use for our other events as well.
Yeah. So anything else about the fest that folks should know about? Obviously, if they're going to come, they need to dress warm. They need to make sure they have good grippy soles or spikies on because it could get pretty slick out there. Anything
Absolutely.
Else that people should be aware of?
No, I think that's the thing. I mean, layer if you can, especially with this crazy weather. You don't want to necessarily be lugging around a big, giant, heavy coat if that sun comes out for that last hour and it's in the upper 40s, but... definitely want to be prepared because, like you said, Frozen River Fest has had so much variance over the years. We've had those freezing blizzard years and then those warmer, icier years. So just come prepared for anything.
Tell folks again where they can get their tickets.
So you can get your tickets either online if you either find our Facebook event, which is connected to our Soldotna Chamber Facebook, or our Frozen River Fest Facebook has all that information. You can also call the chamber. We'll make sure that we have all that link for you. It's also been advertised in our weekly newsletter that we send out. We're happy to get that to you as well. Or you can also get tickets right at the door. That won't be a problem as well. We want to fill out that park as much as we're able, but we always encourage some of those pre-sale tickets just so it's one, so it'll be easier for you to get in. All they'll be doing is quickly scan your tickets, giving you a bracelet, and letting you in rather than having to wait in the lines for tickets.
All righty. Well, hey, sounds good, Joe. I'll see you at it. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us and tell us all about it.
Pleasure. Thank you for calling me. We're excited to have you there as well. Thanks, Bill.
All righty. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment.
Tune in on Sundays from 7 to 9, where I, Josie Oliva, will be your host for Pickled Beats, a radio show that explores obscure subgenres and oddly specific themes right here on Pickle Hill Radio, KDLL.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. Up next in this month's beer style segment, we're going to talk about Pilsners, the most popular beer style in the world. Pilsner is a pale golden lager, originally from the Czech Republic. It revolutionized the brewing world when it first appeared, thanks to its seductive golden glow and crisp, refreshing taste. And thanks to an oversight, which meant that neither the name nor the recipe was patented, it was quickly imitated around the world. Today, for most beer drinkers, Pilsner is simply synonymous with lager. Imitation Pilsners today account for 95% of global beer volume, although most of these beers share little of the character of the original. Like Burton-on-Trent in the UK or Munich in Germany, the town of Pilsen in Bohemia is one of those rare towns where nature just happened to leave the perfect combination of ingredients lying around and phenomenally gifted brewers just happened to come along and find them. The Czechs refer to beer as Czech bread. They have always taken it incredibly serious and drunk a great deal of it. But for most of beer's history, the ability to brew beers to a high and consistent standard lagged behind the demands for quality. In the mid-19th century, the citizens of Pilsen were becoming increasingly concerned with the quality of their beer, culminating in 1838 when an entire season's brew was solemnly poured out in front of the town hall. Something had to be done, and the citizens came together to build a new, state-of-the-art brewery, the Burger Brauery, or Citizens Brewery, uniting their skill and resources, and stealing as many ideas and resources as they could from the neighboring Bavarians. Martin Selzer was commissioned to design and build the new brewery. He traveled extensively around Bavaria and met the man he knew he wanted as brewmaster, Joseph Grohl. At the time, brown Bavarian lager was the most celebrated beer style across Europe, and Grohl was briefed to recreate a Bavarian-style lager at the new Citizens Brewery. He recruited Bavarian brewing assistants and barrel makers and brought Bavarian lager yeast with him. This lager yeast, scientific name Saccharomyces pasteurianus, was a mutated version of ale yeast that liked the cold temperatures at which bacteria could not live, one that fermented without fruity esters and sank to the bottom of the fermenter rather than floating on the top. But what came out of the tanks in October 1842 was not a Bavarian brown lager. The citizens of Pilsen were handed a golden beverage with thick snow-white foam. The drinkers, having tried its sharp, delicious taste, welcomed it with such cheers as has never been experienced in Pilsen before. Bavarian skill had met Czech ingredients. Moravian barley is sweet. Bohemian Saaz hops have little bitterness but lots of aroma, and the very soft sandstone-filtered Pilsen water allows these flavors to come through. Soon, Pilsner beer was being discussed excitedly throughout the Austro-Hungarian Empire and beyond. Perhaps as a result of their intoxicated delight, the Burgers of Pilsen didn't get around to trademarking Pilsner beer until 1859. by which time there were many other beers on the market referring to themselves as Pilsner-style beers. Belatedly, in 1898, the Citizens Brewery registered the original Pilsner, Pilsner Urquell, as a trademark. The Citizens Brewery eventually changed its name to the Pilsner Urquell Brewery and brews still today. It would be incorrect to refer to Pilsner Urquell as the world's first golden beer, as the brewery often does, because color is a function of malt. English pale ale brewers had pioneered the use of pale malt decades previously, and Bavarian lager brewers freely admitted stealing the knowledge to create it from them. But Pilsner was certainly a new style of beer that had not been seen before, and its popularity spread rapidly. The birth of Pilsner lager coincided with the greatest period of scientific innovation in the history of brewing. Railways meant beer could be transported across great distances, and information traveled even faster. Refrigeration meant lagers no longer had to be conditioned in cool caves or deep cellars. And the work of Louis Pasteur and those influenced by him led to the isolation of single-strain yeast that could guarantee product consistency. The consistency became Pilsner's byword, and brands emerged in the late 19th century that still dominate the global beer market today. Pilsners are generally distinguished from other lager styles by their more assertive hop character. Within the style, there are two main geographic variants. Czech Pilsners, such as Pilsner Urquell, tend to be darker in color but delicate in flavor, with floral, grassy aromas, while German Pilsners, such as Bitburger or Warnsteiner, can be more bitter and earthy and use a variety of European noble hops, as well as the beloved Czech Saaz. The Netherlands and Belgium are also home to world-famous international Pilsner brands, such as Heineken or Stella Artois, and these tend to be sweeter with considerably less hop character. Pilsners created the template for the industrial golden lager that dominates the global beer market, and as such, it is often misunderstood. Many so-called Pilsners have none of the character that truly defines the style, having had their maturation time cut and flavor-given ingredients reduced to the point of extinction. Consequently, the first encounter with a true Pilsner can be a life-changing revelation to a drinker who has only previously experienced mass-produced pale imitations. I know mine was. If you're looking to experience a proper Pilsner firsthand, one of the key things to look for is freshness. As an example, canned Pilsner Urquell is often available at Fred Meyer. However, trust me when I tell you that after the rigors of traveling from the Czech Republic to Alaska, it's only a shadow of its former self. I've been fortunate enough to drink it in Prague, fresh from the brewery, and it's truly an amazing beer. However, if you can't swing a trip to the Czech Republic, I'd recommend trying some of our locally produced Pilsners instead. Midnight Sun Brewing Company cans its Wolfpack Pilsner, as does King Street Brewing. Other breweries in Alaska produce Pilsners from time to time as well. However, for my money, the best Pilsner in the state is the Czech Pilsner produced by Zach Henry at St. Elias Brewing in Soldotna. As one of his flagship brews, it's usually on tap and exquisitely fresh. One taste and you'll understand what a Pilsner is meant to be and realize just how this style managed to take the beer world by storm a century and a half ago. We'll be right back with our final segment. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We've all got our pet peeves, the little things that really drive us up the wall. One of mine is sitting down in a nice restaurant and asking to see their beer list, only to be told, "Oh, we have everything." My response, "Really? There are over 9,000 breweries in the U.S. alone, so a conservative estimate would be there are well over 50,000 individual beers brewed in the U.S., not to mention all the cool imports out there, and you've got everything. That's impressive. Okay, I'll have a 1998 Thomas Hardy Ale." At this point, the poor server usually realizes they're dealing with a beer geek, and my wife sighs as she is again reminded that she was foolish enough to marry one. The server then admits that by everything, he or she really means Bud, Bud Light, Miller, Miller Light, Coors, Coors Light, etc., i.e., the same run-of-the-mill macro brews that everyone else has. If I'm really lucky, they might have one local brew of some sort on tap or in a bottle. It will probably be served way too cold and may be so old that it does not taste like anything like it should, but that's the way it goes, right? Can't expect to get what you're paying good money for, i.e. a quality craft beer, properly served. What bothers me most about this is that no self-respecting restaurant would ever respond to a request for its wine list by saying, "We have everything." Nor would they think serving just a run-of-the-mill house white sufficient to satisfy the tastes of all their customers and pair with all their dishes. But they think nothing of treating beer in such a cavalier fashion. This is especially galling as beer makes a much superior pairing with most foods as compared to wine. Since beer is carbonated, the effervescence of the bubbles allows it to disperse more aromas. Given its myriad of styles, beer is far more versatile at mealtime than wine could ever hope to be. Are you having fajitas? The bracing hoppiness of an English pale ale will cut right through the dish's spiciness. Are you having spinach salad? A nice tangy wheat beer will counterbalance the acidity of the dressing. If you're having chocolate cake, then a bold, roasty imperial stout will balance the richness of the dessert. There are beers that work across all these categories, which is not the case with wine. However, more and more chefs are discovering the utility and versatility of beer, both as an ingredient in and as an accompaniment to fine dining. True beer lists are becoming more and more common in fine dining establishments, taking their rightful place alongside the wine lists. Coming from the other direction, more and more breweries and brew pubs are serving food, and that food is becoming increasingly sophisticated. A couple of decades ago, a brew pub could get away with serving a substandard sort of deep-fried pub food, but today's patrons are increasingly looking for something better. If they're going to the trouble to seek out quality handcrafted beers, they expect to be served quality handcrafted foods as well. We can see the intersection of these trends in the growing popularity of what are loosely called beer dinners. These are set menu meals in which each course is accompanied by one or two beers specially selected to go with that course. Under that general umbrella, there are many different subcategories of beer dinner. Some showcase beers from a single brewery, while others might focus on beers from a specific region or country, or even imports from another country, such as Britain or Belgium. I've attended dinners that were billed as a duel between two breweries, in which each course was accompanied by two beers, one from each brewery, and the patrons voted on whose beer paired best with each course. Some dinners focus on aged beers. For years, the famous Humpy's Beer Dinner, held in Anchorage each year during Alaska Beer Week, showcased hard-to-find brews plucked from the extensive personal cellar of Humpy's owner, Billy Opinski. Whatever the chosen theme for any particular dinner, they all share one thing in common. They are a celebration of the excellence of finely crafted beer and its amazing ability to accompany and enhance delicious food. Here on the peninsula, few restaurants are beginning to dip their toes into the beer dinner waters. In the past couple of months, both Girdwood and Bleeding Heart Brewery have sponsored beer dinners featuring their brews. Breweries with food service will also soon be able to offer beer dinners as well. With the recent revision to Title IV that went into effect on January 1, 2024, breweries will be able to obtain restaurant eating place licenses, which will allow them to serve beers other than their own products. Once these new licenses are issued, I expect to see breweries like St. Elias and Kenai River explore hosting their own gourmet beer dinners. If you're a beer lover like me, you should want to see this trend continue. The way to make that happen is to give feedback. If you love beer and don't wish to see it mistreated, speak up. Let the server and or the manager know if you're not happy with the beer choices at the establishment or how their beers are served. If your complaints are ignored, go spend your money someplace else. Conversely, if you find good beer properly served, let the folks doing so know how much you appreciate it. Go to beer dinners and let the staff and owners know just how happy you are to do so. Positive feedback is just as important as negative feedback. Let's put our money where our mouths are and teach people to respect beer. Well, that's it for this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. Our final quote comes from the Canadian essayist Hugh Hood, who said, quote, "Nothing ever tasted better than a cold beer on a beautiful afternoon with nothing to look forward to than more of the same." Until next time, cheers.
Beers of Alaska, here on the last frontier. Beers.